The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. It's 2018. It's time for real estate forecasting. It's being done across the institutional real estate world, and we have two of the finest with us today to talk about 2018. What are the prospects for real estate here in North America? How does that compare vis-a-vis perhaps some overseas investing in places such as Europe or Asia? And how long is this recovery going to last? We're starting to see prices topping out. What property types are poised for a good 2018? Which ones maybe are a little bit infirm at this point? Joining us are Indy Karlikar. He is head of global research at Principal Real Estate Investors, and Doug Putas, who is executive vice president and head of strategy and research at Bentall Kennedy, two formidable organizations in the space. Indy and Doug, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Doug and Mike. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I'm happy to be here too.
Well, let's begin with just kind of an overall look at 2018. What is the forecast for 2018? Indy, why don't you lead off? What are your numbers telling you we can expect this year? And can you kind of make it relative a little bit to 2017? Because I think people are pretty happy with 2017. Are we looking at a better year, an equivalent year, or maybe something that's a little bit more muted?
Yeah, sure. Sure, Mike, thanks. You know, the way we think about things is through a prism of thematic ideas and what might unfold for 2018. So maybe let me just give both of you three or four themes that we've identified that we think will unfold as 2018, as we go through 2018. You know, one is that the macro environment, both in the U.S. and globally, is actually quite constructive. Despite the chaos of politics that we've seen both in the U.S. as well as the uncertainty we see globally, whether it's North Korea, whether it's Brexit, the overall economic environment that we have seen over the last 6 months and expectations for the next 6 to 12 months are actually quite constructive. In fact, globally, we are seeing synchronized growth for the first time since 2010, which again bodes quite well for real estate, which, as we know, is quite correlated to economic growth. So that's the first thing. Second theme is, unfortunately, you know, there's no free lunch. That means that as growth gets remains quite strong in the U.S. and starts to get stronger in Europe, we expect rates to go higher up. We've already seen the Fed articulate three, possibly four hikes in 2018. We've seen the ECB now make noises about winding down its QE program a little shorter. So we expect rates to be slightly higher in 2018 than they were in 2017. Having said so, we are quite constructive on real estate. That's our third theme, is we are constructive on real estate as an asset class. And you asked the question relative. Well, we see relative not only to what we've seen over the, perhaps not as strong as 2017, let me be honest about that. We've seen very, very strong performance, especially from core real estate. I think going forward, 2018 is probably going to see the continuation of the temperance that we saw in core real estate returns. But if you look at real estate in the broader context of other asset classes, I think real estate still holds its own, especially if you can generate decent NOI growth, reasonable cap rates, going in cap rates, you get to a total unlevered return of 6 to 7%. I don't think investors are going to be too upset with that. Finally, a fourth thematic idea is, despite the generally good outlook that we have, the generally constructive outlook that we have, we are telling investors to brace for uncertainty. I know it's a big term. There's a lot of potential out there, and it's hard to quantify where that uncertainty may come from. And certainly the timing of any of these risks boiling over is quite uncertain. But what we're telling investors, watch the capital markets closely. See what they do over the next 12 months. See what the capital market signals to see what kind of uncertainty may take shape. In a nutshell, quite constructive in 2018, but expectations are more tempered for certainly compared to 2017.
So, Doug, what is your outlook? And maybe you can add the dimension of any kind of distinction between Canada and the United States, if in fact any distinction really exists. It almost feels like one big market these days. So what do you say?
Yeah, I would start by saying, absent any specific external black swan event, which I think is what Indy was referring to in his last one there, the outlook is positive. Economic growth remains solid, if not robust. We don't see much evidence at all of significant new imbalances, either economic or property, developing, at least yet. And the ones that have over the last year or two, such as the urban high-end apartments becoming slightly oversupplied and new office supply in especially New York, appear to be self-correcting with the rising development costs and slowing rent growth that have already made fewer new projects pencil out. Specifically, as it relates to Canada versus the U.S., some of those political cross currents in the United States have actually created some tremendous new growth into Canada. Students from around the world have flocked to the United States over the last 50 years, and they've been a tremendous fuel for the United States. They've also flocked to Canada, and right now that talent is marginally going more to Canada than it is to the United States. So Canada had its best year of this cycle. In 2017. Don't think that's necessarily going to continue into 2018, but there's a lot of things going well in Canada. Specifically, Montreal has, I've been in this business for 37 years, and for 37 years, even before I was actively thinking about it, Montreal has been in tough times. Montreal really seems to be coming out of it. So, Toronto, Vancouver, very much like the American markets, very highly valued, very high home prices, et cetera. Montreal, very large market, has really started getting its sea legs and will be interesting to watch over the next couple of years.
And any of our listeners who don't understand why I took Doug Poutas to the border, it's, again, he is an executive with Bentall Kennedy. And just in case some of our listeners are not aware, Bentall Kennedy is based in Canada. And although it's extremely active in the United States as well. Doug brings a little different perspective to this. You know, gentlemen, we've got something going on right now, worldwide growth. All cylinders seem to be hitting right now. Europe has resuscitated. The United States is growing. In fact, we've had an uptick in GDP growth. And with expectations of possibly more with the major tax cut that's in play right now. And in Asia, there's some of the fastest growing economies with India and China. And at one point, I know the Philippines was a very fast growth economy. I'm not sure if that's been curtailed at this point. But what about just that the fact that the worldwide economy seems to all be in sync right now? How big a factor, how big an energy hit is that going to be for real estate in North America, Indy?
Yeah, I think having a broadly constructive global environment for growth, Mike, is actually quite positive for real estate. If you look at what the main demand drivers of real estate tend to be, labor markets, trade, and goods, both are, I would say, would be positively impacted by global growth. After all, global growth does help U.S. exports. U.S. exports helps our manufacturing, helps our logistics, helps our warehouses. Exports and services helps our office market. So there is, I would say, a virtuous cycle of global growth that the U.S. real estate markets can benefit from, indirectly and directly. Another way of thinking about it is capital flows, right? So we've seen a lot of capital come to the U.S. over the last 3 to 4 years from offshore capital, whether sovereign funds, institutional investors, name it. I think that trend remains in place because foreign investors want to place their capital, and they want to place their capital in an environment where growth is accelerating. So I think it sets up for a benign environment for the next 12 months at least, and barring any black swans that I think I'm fully in concurrence with Doug on, I think global growth is generally quite constructive for real estate.
And Doug, what do you think about that? And I want to just also ask you about pricing, because the gateway markets around the world have gotten really frothy lately. And there's been talk about more organizations, more investors spilling over to secondary markets and whatnot. What do you think in terms of the synchronized growth going on, and whether this is going to maybe push the pressure on prices even higher at a time when a lot of investors are saying, certain big markets like London and New York are just too darn expensive?
Yeah, well, I'll start with maybe a question on global growth that, you know, U.S. interest rates, I like to say U.S. interest rates have been high, not low, and U.S. cap rates are high, not low. And obviously the rates in the U.S. and around the world are very low by any historic measure. But on a relative basis, our rates have been high, and that's been one of the reasons why we've attracted so much capital from around the world. When you have, you know, the majority of sovereign bonds in Europe trading at negative rates, it really drives, you know, and that was a year and a half ago, really drove money into the U.S. They're still basically trading at close to zero, and it really drives money towards the high rates of the U.S., which we think are low, but which are high by their measures. So with this global synchronized growth, now we get the question of not only does the U.S. have interest rate increases, but what about the others? Indy mentioned that the ECB is shifting its posture. But if we move to significantly higher rates, it will be interesting to see how that could potentially play out, that if you know, Germany starts, you know, if the German bonds start trading at 3% instead of at effectively zero, what does that do? That's not going to happen in 2018. It's probably not going to happen in 2019. But as we get to normalization of rates, it won't just occur in the United States. It will likely occur around the rest of the world. Now, with that, John, I've forgotten the second part of your question.
You know, it's the two-part question was the synchronized growth, what kind of vitalizing effect that will have on the real estate industry, but also there's also that's an antecedent condition to what could be higher prices. We're already at frothy price levels, and a really strong real estate market continues to push those prices to the point where some people are saying, you know, this doesn't pencil anymore.
Right. Yeah. So the global markets question, and I like the way that you phrased it as New York and London, because there really are a handful of truly global markets, and the United States has a lot of markets and a lot of very large markets. But from a global investor's perspective, there's New York, and then there's, and I've been involved in many discussions with investors where they then say Washington, and then there's San Francisco, and then there's Los Angeles, but they don't agree. So it's New York and something else. And we really see that in the pricing of that market. In this cycle, San Francisco's come right with it because it had such a strong demand side. But in general, it's these handful of truly global markets that are in normal times, and usually not even in normal times, highly liquid, able to absorb large dollars of capital so that even the largest investors don't have to worry about moving the market by themselves. I've never thought that they were even frothy in this cycle. What they are is appropriately valued for all those positive characteristics. That means for investors seeking higher returns, they're probably not the right place to be. It's a bit like saying that, would you say that AAA bonds are frothy because they trade at a significantly lower interest rate than BB bonds? No bond investor would ever say that. They might say they were frothy when they were outside their normal relative pricing range. But I don't think they've gotten outside their normal relative pricing range this time. They are just places that are highly liquid, have shown tremendous resilience over long cycles, and thus are and can absorb large amounts of capital, and thus are, you know, easily investable. I do think that what you always have to look at in those markets is what are the risks of them overbuilding themselves given all that flow of capital. Historically, London was very constrained on the supply side. This cycle, London has really started to build significantly new supply. We see tremendous supply in some of the other world's global markets or emerging markets. And frankly, this cycle, for the first time again in my professional lifetime, New York is in a significant supply cycle. So it's having that impact. So I keep coming back to what's the impact on supply. And, you know, if this period of expansion and global positive synchronization goes on for another 3, 4, 5 years, the supply effects will compound on themselves.
Now, you mentioned liquidity, and it does, you know, when you're in the United States, Canada, North America, there's certainly liquidity in the real estate market. But what I've been seeing lately, and I don't, this is completely anecdotal and little bit instinctive, which is always dangerous. It just seems that more real estate investors, greater numbers of real estate investors, are buying properties for a long-term hold. I think we're all old enough to remember when the Japanese came in the United States and bought lots of real estate assets, and they just took a beating on them. But the fact of the matter is, if they had held on to those properties, everything would have worked out just fine. And I don't know what kind of pressures, domestic pressures they had on them or the banks had on them at the time. But is there, and I'm talking to two guys who are part of the brain trust that tells investors, you know, what kind of hold time they should be looking at. And real estate always seems to work out if you have a long time horizon. Is there a trend towards longer holds, Indy, or is this a figment of my imagination at this point?
No, I think it's not a figment of your imagination, Mike. Let me step back for a second. I think there'll be, you know, investors will sell at a price. You know, there's always a price, right? So I think the danger is you fall in love. You don't want to fall in love with your asset class. And I think investors want to be mindful of that. That being said, I think what we are, certainly our experience is the following, that institutional investors, large institutional investors, are essentially taking a hard look at their portfolio construction. The CIOs of the world are taking a close look at how real estate fits into that portfolio. And then they're dovetailing that with the expectations on the yield environment that they're potentially going to face over the next 5 to 7 years. And if we do believe that rates do go higher in the next 3 to 4 years, globally, not just in the U.S., they still would be quite low compared to what we've seen in the 80s and the 90s. And I think what that's leading to some institutional investors thinking is that, actually, for solving some of my long-term asset liability problems that I'm facing, real estate's actually a pretty good asset class to hold in my portfolio. And it's not a trading class. It's not a trading asset class, i.e. I don't necessarily want to use it to generate alpha because A, it's hard, and B, it's expensive. Maybe if I get really good real estate beta in my portfolio, it solves two issues for me. One is it generates decent income, more than decent especially, and B, it provides me with some capital uplift when I need it. So I think you've seen a little bit of that change at starting to occur in some large institutions that is leading to them saying, hang on, let me hold on to my real estate asset rather than use it for a trading strategy. And that's exactly what you've seen with some very large sovereign funds make some very notable transactions over the last 18 months in markets like New York and London, where they paid what seems to be fairly full price for some assets, but their view is we're going to hold this for, you know, 30 to 50 years in our portfolio because it has all these interesting characteristics that we think would be very helpful to our portfolio. So I think that, in my view, is what's happening, Mike, is that there's been a bit of a change in the way portfolio construction is being viewed amongst institutional investors.
What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I'm going to come at it from a slightly different perspective. I think Indy's answer for institutional investors is dead on. But I'm going to say there's another class of investor out there, which is the ultra-high net worth. And you almost need to call them ultra-ultra-high net worths. And they're their own independent sovereign wealth funds. We have the greatest wealth discrepancy recorded, really, in the world. The comparable in the modern era at all is the 1880, 1890, 1900 industrial barons period, and that fueled some very long-term holding. New York for the longest time had very limited institutional ownership because almost all the top office properties were held by the variably called 5, 6, or 7 families. I think we're entering a period where we may be replicating some of that, and we've seen that in a handful of transactions, a little bit more in Canada even than the U.S., of, you know, people showing up who really, I like to call them owners, not investors. You know, they are putting their money in something with the very explicit assumption that they're going to hold it for 50 to 100 years, that it's a real asset, and it's a way to park. And, you know, the frightening thing is, I'm going sideways to say, the frightening thing is when they buy a $300 million office building, it's a quarter of 1% of their net worth. It's not a material holding to them necessarily. You know, when you've got families that are worth more than 100, have wealth over $100 billion, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it, diversify it across currencies, diversify it across political regimes, trying to make it perpetual, they become their own sovereign wealth funds.
Interesting. Yeah, and the number of super wealthy families around the world is just incredible how quickly that is growing. In fact, we have an item going in the magazine in Real Assets Advisor that shows that the richest of the rich, basically the 1% added $1 trillion to their net worth in 2017, which is just astounding. Let's stipulate that in the best of times, when things are good, there's plenty of bad real estate deals. And when things are bad, there's plenty of good real estate deals. So kind of with that as a backdrop, let's talk about property types, because not all property types are going to perform equally. They never do. And in 2018, that's going to be the case for sure. So Indy, let's start with you in terms of what property type or two do you especially like, and which ones would you keep your position small in or even avoid altogether?
Sure, Mike. I think, look, investors will always have appetite for all the main food groups, right? Because they'll find some redeeming qualities about multifamily or industrial or whatever. So having said so, I'm going to sound like a bit like a lemming, but I'm going to tell you that our favorite property types as we look at it 2018 probably still remains the industrial logistics sector. It still continues to see a significant weight of capital, and I think it's still interesting because, in my view, it represents the innovation part of the business cycle, i.e. it's really bleeding the frontiers between retail and logistics, and it's participating in the whole exciting part of innovation that the U.S. economy is very strong in. So I think industrial remains an attractive place to put capital to work in 2018. I think multifamily, which Doug alluded to, has gotten hammered, especially in the urban high-end sectors, still remains a little bit of a punch. But multifamily has some defensive qualities, especially the affordable segment. I completely agree with Doug's team of income inequality. It's getting worse by the day. And there is a significant shortage of what I call quote-unquote, affordable housing in the U.S., especially in the coastal markets where house prices have elevated so much. I think there's some interesting opportunities to play in that space as we look out at 2018. What we are being a little cautious on is in the office space. Office has, it's a high beta property type. It's also got very high CapEx and TI operating costs. And what we found over the last 12 months is that TI packages have actually gotten larger and larger as time has gone by. And so we think office is probably a good place to perhaps be a little underweight in your portfolios. And retail is the one, I know we're going to speak about this later on, but retail, we are being very careful. I mean, there's a lot of carnage that has occurred. We think there's a lot of moving parts still in retail. There are going to be some winners, there are going to be some losers, and we're going to be played predominantly through the grocery anchored space. Some power centers, some big boxes still will work, but we're being quite cautious on retail, really speaking. So industrial multifamily is probably where we think the best opportunities lie in 2018.
What do you say, Doug?
Yeah, I'm going to start by giving an unsolicited shout-out to Indy and to Principal for being the Odyssey Fund. I believe, Indy, it's is right, with the highest industrial weight. And having built that position several years ago, it's been their investors have really benefited from it. And I concur with what he says about the distribution and logistics properties. We've been attempting to build, we've been market weight, trying to get to overweight, and just haven't been as good at getting it done as they have. So, I'll start with that. But yes, the trouble for retail is the benefit for distribution and logistics, but it's not just e-commerce. It's a lot of other things. It really is the segment that is got the best clear path to continued demand growth. Always have to watch out for the supply growth there, and really pay pick and choose as you get into this point in the cycle, because while they're big boxes, they're pretty quick to build and often built not where the land is very valuable. So we've tried to shift our focus more towards the infill type, whether you call it last mile. It's not really the last mile, but the things that are serving the local demand, that to us is a real strong sector. The other one that we see as a real positive sector is medical office and clinics. The U.S. population is getting materially older. We baby boomers are now, I'm 61. I'm only a few years from that point when my medical demands start doubling every 10 years. There's tremendous demand for healthcare. And it really is almost a retail type business. The healthcare, it's not hospitals, it's the healthcare that you deal with on a regular basis. So it needs a retail type location. So medical office and clinic is one that we see as being very well positioned for the next year. Again, despite a little bit of the noise that comes out of healthcare reform, Affordable Care Act stuff, the underlying demand is there no matter what. On the retail front, I completely concur. We've been underweight retail for almost forever, but since I joined the firm 7 years ago, we've been explicitly underweight retail. We're nibbling around the edges there because we think that, often when the tide goes out, you can still pick up some opportunities. So we're seeing some what we think is attractive relative pricing around the edges in retail because a lot of people are trying to lower their weights. We want to maintain our weight. We don't want to increase it. We're going to stay underweight, but we still see some opportunity there. And apartments, longer term, there's tremendous growth in demand for housing in the United States. We have close to 1% growth, natural rate of increase in households. Assuming that we don't get back to the extraordinary home ownership, no sign we're going back to that type of home ownership, something approaching 40% of the U.S. population will be housed in rental housing. That's just a lot of demand.
Andy, I want to come back to you for a minute. You mentioned TIs, tenant improvements in office buildings getting really expensive. Why is that? It would seem that there is not a surfeit of space in office. Why the pressure on tenant improvements that lands on the building owner?
Mike, so I want to understand the two reasons that are driving the TI packages. One is that the type of tenancy that we are seeing in some of the office buildings is different from what it was 10 or 15 years ago. So it is, media tenants that have different space requirements and have different requirements for their workforce. So newer, social places are much more important than cubicles. And that takes a different kind of expense ratio attached to it. So that's one significant reason that's driving up TI packages, is that the nature of tenancy is very different from what it was. It's not white shoe law firms or investment banks. It's the creative media technology companies that are really driving the demand for different use of space, which is driving TI packages. That's a big reason. The second is scarcity of labor, to be honest. The 7 years ago, when the global financial crisis had a whole class of construction workers was essentially taken out of the market. And that shortage still remains in place, and that's really led to a big pickup in costs for the contractors, and they're passing it on to the underlying owners. And we're seeing that directly in wage bills, in labor bills, and that's driving up TI packages too. So it's these two factors that, certainly from my experience, has driven up TI package cost.
I'm going to go back and start with the very first thing when you said there's a surfeit of space.
I used the wrong word.
Vacancy
didn't I?
Rates.
I don't mean a plethora of space. I mean that actually the supply is tight right now. Correct.
Well, that's it's not.
It
is.
Okay.
It is on a relative basis. It is relative to history, but the overall office vacancy rate in the U.S. is 13%. Even the tight office markets, with the exception of San Francisco a couple times recently, but even the tight office markets are 5, 6, and 7% vacant. The apartment market is considered loosening now with a 5% vacancy rate. The warehouse distribution market, they don't quote vacancy rates, they quote availability rates. Well, availability rates are a higher number than vacancy rates because availability rates include space that's occupied today that will be available. and they're in the nationally in the 6, 7, 8% range, and in the tight markets, they're effectively zero. I mean, in inner Los Angeles, there's effectively zero vacancy. So, you know, while office is tighter than it has been historically, we have so much office space in this country that there's always a competing bid. You know, there's almost never, when you're dealing with a tenant, you're almost never their only choice. And that's just not true in the industrial space. You often are pretty close to their only space.
Interesting. So let's drill down on retail just a little bit quickly. It seems that retail has become the most complicated property type because consumer predilections change so rapidly. The format needs to change. You have to think in terms of the retail mix, and then you've got the pressures from e-commerce. And in urban areas, just people who realize that there's an awful lot of time involved in going shopping to bricks and mortar just because of the traffic, distance, parking, and so on. Within the retail sector, what do investors really need to be looking to or be especially cognizant of, perhaps on the downside? What do you say, Indy?
So, you know, it is a complicated place. And what we are kind of trying to, as Pat, and try and make sense of what might happen over the next 2 to 3 years, maybe even beyond, some things have become quite clear to us. One is that commodity type of retail is really going to come under pressure and probably go away more. I mean, commodity, by that I mean, you know, apparel, your middle of the mall tenants, your Abercrombies, your American Eagles, stuff that you can buy online, is probably going to go away because it doesn't make sense. Anything that can be delivered more efficiently via e-commerce that doesn't necessarily require high touch, I think is going to face challenges. In turn, that means that some of the big box concepts, some of the big traditional department stores, your Macy's, your Penny's, your Sears, are probably going to be challenged in the years going ahead, unless they dramatically revamp themselves and think of some other business models that they can adapt to over the next 3 to 5 years. That in turn leads us to where do you think safety would be, right, in this environment? And where would not only be safety, but perhaps find some reasonable margin for growth? And what we've been trying to do, and again, echoing what Doug says, nibble at the margins, is we've been trying to get access to well-located grocery anchored centers. And now that might seem a little bit oxymoronic given the recent Whole Foods acquisition by Amazon, but we actually think that's a vindication for well-located grocery anchored stores. People still need to buy, people still need to shop, essential items still need to be purchased on a daily basis. And we think that's probably what makes sense. Unfortunately, a lot of other investors have also recognized it, and we've seen that reflected in pricing. So grocery anchored stores are not bargains by any means. So what we're saying is, let's look for maybe, you know, community centers, power centers that are about 250,000 square feet, anchored by a solid grocer, a good credit, good tenant, maybe has a couple of boxes around it with reason in place that even if they go dark, you can perhaps replace them. What we're trying to do essentially is being defensive. So be focused on grocery anchored stores, well-known national names that can hold their own against the e-commerce giants that are going to go into the space. Look for smaller footprints, be defensive. That's what we're saying about the retail space. Stay away from B, C type of malls. You know, I wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. You can't even finance those things. In other words, be highly selective. That's kind of our message. And be watchful for the capital markets, be watchful for credit trends. Even the most defensive fortress malls, in my view, are not going to be as fortress as investors think.
And, you know, you mentioned Whole Foods. I'm glad you did, Indy, because I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal, this is probably 10 years ago, high-rise condominiums fighting tooth and nail to try to get Whole Foods in their ground floor, because what had been discovered in the real estate business was the value of the condos in your high-rise went up significantly if you had a Whole Foods on the ground floor. And so, Doug, this kind of gets back to the whole location, location, location. I hate the cliche, but everybody understands it, that it's so convenient to order stuff online. But if you're in a building and the ground floor has got a Whole Foods, there is still a desirable experience to actually be able to put your hands on the produce and have a little bit of socialization as part of the experience of shopping. I don't know. I just wanted to throw that in there, but that might be a component of your response to what we need to do with retail.
Well, that was exactly. It's a great lead-in. It's all about experiential, commodity retail, and Indy and I could have a long discussion about the exact definition of commodity. I disagree slightly with his, but it doesn't matter. The experiential component. I said this a few years ago. My parents never ate out. My wife and I, my wife's a wonderful cook. We have a wonderful family life. We eat out, you know, 10 times a week. I don't know, 6 times, 8 times a week. My daughters don't eat in. They may order in. They don't eat in. It's all prepared foods. It's all things. The reason Whole Foods on your ground floor is a great addition is Whole Foods is experiential retail. Whole Foods has great food bars. They have great prepared food bars. You do sense the produce. You do go there for the quality of it. It's part of an experience. And that's what's in demand. You know, years ago, when you looked at a shopping center and it had a movie theater, you and it said, I don't know if we want to do this. It's a movie theater. Well, now that movie theater is actually a restaurant that happens to show a movie while it's, you know, bringing the food to your lounge chair. And all of a sudden you're looking for them. Same thing with health clubs. Health clubs were always something you only put in a shopping center when it was failing. Now they were a key anchor to it because they bring visits. They bring experiences to people. On the commodity side, I just have a brief anecdote to tell. We had a visitor from Romania staying with us for a couple weeks around Thanksgiving. We were enjoying dinner on his last evening with us. It was the first Sunday in December, and about 8 p.m. the doorbell rang. Now, that doesn't happen that often in my house. There was a delivery person with a package for our guest. When I asked what it was, and after getting over the shock of a delivery on a Sunday night, he said one of his friends back home had messaged him the day before asking if he'd be willing to bring this small little electronic component back with him. He'd ordered it online on Saturday from Romania. The point of sale was in Texas. And it arrived at our house on Sunday night at 8 p.m. in time for this guy to get on a plane the next morning back to Romania.
It's amazing.
It's no longer 2 days delivery, 1 day delivery. The you know, in my neighborhood, the Amazon van is on the street every single day. Usually I see it. If I'm around for more than a couple hours, I will see that van on my street. It is just a continuous stream of now same-day deliveries. So if it's not experiential, there isn't much point in going in making the trip. And that's why grocery anchored is the place you have to go, because good grocery anchored still gives experience, but the other thing is load them up with restaurants, deal with the credit problems. You get back to the TI problem. You got to be real careful with the restaurants, but load them up with things that make people want to go there.
Well, and you know, the whole idea of getting back to Whole Foods being in the ground floor of a residence, the idea of being able to shop like Europeans at the daily stop at the market, you're only picking up a few items, it's very fresh. You make it that day, and the next day you're back at the market for just a quick visit and picking things up. I mean, the reason I think we don't shop like Europeans most of the time is, besides the fact that a lot of us don't cook, is that it's the time consumption, whereas in Europe there's just markets everywhere. There's a lot of foot traffic. You can get in and out. I'll make a blue sky prediction right now. Somebody from Cirque du Soleil is going to get into the retail business, and they're going to figure out how to bring people in and have a major entertainment component that's going to go along with the food and the items that online e-commerce does not do well with or cannot deliver in that same way. Like I said, blue sky prediction, but let's go to supply and demand and whether they're in balance. Both of you have spoken to this just a little bit, but just generally speaking, where are the categories where you would say we're in balance? Is there any categories where you would say we're getting overbuilt? And I realize this is more complicated than that, because then you have to start talking about cities or regions or even submarkets. But if you could take your best swipe at that, Andy, what would you how would you answer that?
Mike, I would start by just prefacing saying that construction financing is still quite hard to get You know, we are very big lenders in the space, and we've been very circumspect in providing construction finance. So that has led to different forms of capital entering the space. But generally speaking, it is difficult to develop on a speculative basis right now. That has generally been quite helpful for real estate. And, you know, the broad big picture, I think if we look out of the next 12 months, supply is generally in check. Now, as Doug already mentioned, there are pockets where there are supply concerns. Certainly, I think luxury high-end, the super high-end multifamily segment has been oversupplied for the last 2-3 years. We see that tapering off a little bit, but that's still a point of concern to us. Select office markets, New York, San Francisco, the most perhaps egregious, we have seen that, but we're seeing that taper down also a little bit. Logistics, industrial is what we started to watch now a little carefully because it's relatively quick spike in industrial development. We have seen industrial pick up quite a bit, the development cycle in response to very strong demand. So we've become a little bit more watchful, but at this point, absorption still exceeds new development. So we're not there yet. And retail really hasn't seen a whole lot of new development. So I don't think that's too much of a concern right now, Mike. I think unless the changes in regulation that are being proposed by the administration do kick in significantly and in quick fashion, i.e. banks go back into the business of making very large other large institutions step back in and start to provide big dollars to spec construction, I think we're okay from a new supply perspective for the next 12 months. Mm.
Well, I'll jump in and just say that last qualifier, I think, is a critical one, the next 12 months. We are in a cycle, especially in non-supply-constrained markets. So the supply-constrained markets came back very strongly in this cycle and started delivering supply fairly early, the Boston, San Francisco, New York. And now those supply constraints are operating. Right, they drove land prices up quite dramatically. The next set of new supply became much more expensive than the previous set of new supply. And while many of us kept funding, it became, you had to sharpen and sharpen the pencil. And now we're sort of seeing the other side of that. We're seeing the decline in new supply in those markets. What came back late in this cycle were the traditional growth markets. The Atlantas, the Floridas, they had a weak economic, they took a big economic hit. They had a weak economic recovery in the early stages. They're now coming back. In those markets, the longer the cycle goes, the more they will develop. Since they're not supply constrained, their cost of adding new supply doesn't increase materially as they add more. Dallas has increased its warehouse development each of the last 6 years. Each year, their demand has grown by more than that increase in new supply, so their vacancies keep going down. But they're now at close to record levels of development. When this does come to an end, they will be still delivering that last years of supply. And if it had happened 3 years ago, it wouldn't have been that many square feet. Now it's going to be a lot of square feet. So that's the worry as this goes ahead, that supply really kicks in. I agree with Indy that the construction lending, I'm going to come to that as an investment opportunity in a second, construction lending has been pretty constrained. People have had to use a lot of equity to get there. I think that is the constraint is backing off somewhat. It always takes longer than people think for construction lenders to get bullish. I do think the regulatory environment, potential regulatory changes could cause more of that. But I'm also looking at the tax code, and I do go back to 1981, and I saw the after effects of that major change in the tax code. There seem to be some things in this tax code that could lead to tax-induced real estate activity. And if that were to come in, that could also amplify the impact in the easy supply markets.
Mm, interesting. And I tell you, I want to give a shout out to Doug Putas. Our listeners, you wouldn't know it, but Doug, from listening to Doug, but he is actually suffering from some flu symptoms. But Doug, you're a trooper. You don't sound at all like your supply and demand is out of balance right now. So I appreciate that. Now, Indy, let me ask you about a term I've been hearing called relative value. I want to know, let's talk about it with respect to real estate, because I'm not sure that I understand the relative value of real estate, let's say transcontinentally, between, say, the United States and Europe. And Europe happens to be a place where principal is playing a bigger role than ever. So how does explain to me relative value with regard to real estate when you're comparing, say, the United States or North America with a continent like Europe? Because obviously a lot of investors are spreading their chips around and looking at Europe as a good place to place some of their assets.
That's a really good question, Mike, and there's no easy or straightforward answer to relative value. What we think about relative value, at its most crudest term, relative value would be, where's the opportunity for better total returns? Is it better here in this market or this property type, et cetera, et cetera? But we think, relative value is really a combination of many different factors, and let me just mention three of them. One is, where are interest rates? Right? Are interest rates higher in a market relative to another market? That has implications for what might do for cap rates. Look at capital flows. Are capital flows stronger in North America or are they stronger in Europe? Again, that has a bearing on where values might be, where capital is going. Whether it's higher transaction volume, you might argue that it might be higher valuations. And then you've got to look at, we look at NOI growth. Where's the potential for higher NOI growth? And that, I think, is very important. Is the environment in Europe more conducive to strong NOI growth over the next 2 to 3 years, or vice versa, is the environment in North America more conducive for NOI growth? When you start packaging these three or four variables together, it gives you a holistic picture on where you might, if you approach it from the perspective of the investor, okay, Indy, Doug, give me, I have a dollar to invest today, where's your best idea to invest in, whether it's in Europe or North America? That's how I think about relative value. Where's the best relative value for investing your dollar in over the next 2 to 3 years? And this is how we come to relative value, is assembling these three or four variables and then identifying, I guess, mispricing or different pricing opportunities that we think will lead to a better investment outcome over the shorter term. When we get into the longer term, then I think it gets more into a strategic discussion on how and why you want to invest in real estate.
Got it. Thank you for that. We're running a little bit long on time, but I do have a few more questions I want to ask you fellas. And Doug, let's talk about demographics. Obviously, they have a big impact on real estate. Are the demographics favorable right now in North America? In what sense are they favorable? And do you see any unfavorable trends that presage maybe some rougher times ahead for real estate?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the glass half full part of this, because while the peak years of the millennials have now reached adulthood, some of those have not yet entered the labor force. So, the millennials in 1980 to 2000 birth, a larger generation than the baby boom. All but the tail end of the millennials have now entered adulthood, supposedly. But they've not all entered the labor force. The reason, though, there's a positive here is, unlike the baby boom followed by the Gen X, the baby bust, there was no significant drop off in births after the millennial birth cohort. And so the number of new 22-year-olds, to just pick a random age when you think they might enter adulthood, declines only modestly. Very unlike what happened in the late part of the 1980s, which fueled a lot of upset in the market as you kind of lost the growth in the young labor pool. On the unfavorable side, what we're tracking closely is that mobility has just collapsed in the United States. The willingness, the actual moving from one location to another. 2017 saw the lowest recorded rate of moving. It's been in secular decline since at least the 1970s. But in the previous cycles, it has increased as the economy strengthens, and that follows something I first observed in my old economic forecasting days in the 1980s, that people move to jobs. They don't move away from unemployment. So when the economy strengthens, mobility usually relatively strengthens. It is just almost in free fall at this point. It's really quite shocking to sort of look at the chart, which is in our publication we just released. We believe that this traces to a couple things. One is the skills mismatch, that the jobs that are in demand, the open positions, are largely come with pretty high skills requirements. And a lot of the people who are stuck in the pockets of unemployment sprinkled around the U.S. Don't have those skills. And but it also, I think, has to do with the political and cultural division that exists in this country, and that there is, you know, a lot of people don't want to move from, you know, Ohio to New York. And then finally, if your skill level is such that what you're qualified for is a minimum wage or close to minimum wage job, then moving to a very high cost location where there's jobs doesn't do you any good, because you're left not being able to afford to live there. In the past, the growth in the country was often in lower cost locations. You know, the Sun Belt coming alive with air conditioning after the 1940s and 50s, or the Industrial Revolution bringing people towards what weren't actually that expensive locations in the Midwest before that. So there's a lot of different factors going on, but this mobility issue is pretty troubling demographically, because it means that we're going to apparently continue this pattern of having pockets of strong growth but struggling to meet its labor demands, and pockets with very limited labor demand and people struggling to find jobs.
Interesting. Andy, what do you see with demographically?
Yeah, I just want to pick up on a very important point Doug made about skills mismatch. And I would just say there's one issue that I think is of concern for anyone who's investing in the U.S. or for anyone who's looking at the long-term prospects for the U.S. is, if you look at our labor force participation levels, they have fallen to a record low. And the skills mismatch is a glaring issue, I think, one problem. We've historically been a country that's welcoming to qualified immigrants. I think the immigration policy that we're seeing currently on the table is potentially a pretty significant challenge to the U.S. growth outlook. Well, one feature that has helped this country navigate over the last 15 or 20 years is that it continues to attract younger people, that helps its demographic profile. Contrast that with Japan. Contrast that with some of the older European markets. They are facing acute labor shortages because they don't have the people to fill the jobs. And they have immigration policies, especially in Japan, that is not helpful to them ever filling these jobs. And so I think, dovetail with all the points that Doug made, having a immigration policy that's perhaps not as conducive to and open to highly skilled labor, which is what we precisely need at this point, is going to be challenging for the economy, and it's going to be in turn challenging for any investment class in this country, leave alone real estate. So that's something that I think you need to be thinking about, Mike, as we look out over the next 2 or 3 years, or more longer, because this could be a structural issue. If you look at the U.S. pattern of growth over the last decade, a lot of the positive demographic growth that has occurred has been because of net immigration.
There are so many people in this country who don't really understand that. Indeed, that the whole shrinking populations in Italy and Germany and Japan, and the fact that we managed to actually keep our population relatively young because we have had that strong immigration. You know, it's a beautiful thing when people want to come into your country rather than want to leave your country. And we've had so much brain gain over the years through immigration, university students coming to the United States and staying here and so on. And who's going to pay for the Social Security? Who's going to pay for Medicare? And on and on. And there's just a lot of people, I think, in our country who don't really understand that dynamic and just what a bracing effect strong immigration has on a national economy. But we'll save that for another day. Let's talk about this real estate cycle. The economic recovery right now is the second longest in United States history. At some point, there's going to be a correction, but everybody seems to be saying it's not going to happen in 2018. When does the real estate bull run for real estate run out? What do you say, Doug?
I say I expect it to last until it ends. It could be next year, could be 3 years out, could be 4 years out. You cited the statistic. As measured from the last peak, this cycle is now as long as any in modern American history. But as measured from when jobs exceeded the previous peak, since we really moved into expansion, which to me is the most important measure of real estate demand. This cycle is of average length. The 60s, the 80s, and the 90s were almost twice as long. We're only just approaching 4 years of true jobs expansion nationally, and those went 8 years. So that's why I say it could be soon, it could be longer. There's nothing inherent in what's going on in real estate that I think is going to bring an end to it. It's going to be some outside thing. This is not the late 1980s when it was quite clear that we needed it to end because we were just overbuilding so grossly. And it's not the 2006-2007, you know, housing bubble part where that prices couldn't go up forever. There's nothing really going on within the real estate market that's causing it. So it's going to be some external black swan or gray swan now. There's some things that are pretty clearly on the horizon that to me is what's likely to bring it to an end.
You know, Indy, I hear this really repeatedly, that nobody's really seeing any red flags out there that are indicating that there may be danger ahead. I'm assuming you concur. What do you think about the durability of this recovery?
Yeah, I don't really disagree with Doug. I would just maybe say there are things that we're looking at that might give us some indications that the cycle is perhaps getting a little long in the tooth. You know, we're looking at rates, obviously, and more importantly, look at how quickly rates go up. So far, the yield curve has flattened, so it's perhaps not so much of a concern. Look at capital market flows. You know, transaction volumes start to peter off sharply. That might be a sign that investors are looking elsewhere. Look at NOI growth. You know, if NOI growth starts to flag, then maybe it's a sign that real estate's taking a breather. And finally, look at supply. You know, I mean, that's really been the bad actor in previous cycles. You get too much supply, and boom, there goes the cycle. So I agree with we're in a funny situation. You know, we are at the long expansion, but it doesn't feel that there are particularly strong imbalances. So what we are trying to do is just keep an eye out on these three or four factors and see when they start to become, when we start to see a confluence of these three or four factors, that's perhaps when we start to get the potential signal that, yeah, real estate perhaps is going to start to see some fade away.
Well, gentlemen, this has been great. I got one final question for you. I would like to hear what you think might be the two or three or four North American cities that you expect to sizzle in 2018. Doug, why don't you lead off with that one?
Yeah, I think you'll know by now that I don't really expect much sizzle in this 10th year of the recovery, now growth. Austin was sizzling, and it may get back to sizzling, but, you know, its supply is just going great guns. So we don't think it's a great place to invest now. I mean, you can be sizzling on the supply side, and that doesn't make it a good place to invest. Raleigh, North Carolina, is a market that we believe is well poised for 2018. It's got the excellent educational institutions in it and around it. It's got a strong labor pool, relatively low costs of living and operating. Denver, similarly positioned. It's not quite as strong on the education front, but it certainly is strong on attracting the young talent. And in our model, young talent is what really matters. And finally, I just, at least for, you know, the end of this year or in the next few years, wherever Amazon chooses to put HQ2, if it actually follows through and does that, and if it actually picks an American city, my money in our internal pool was actually on a Canadian city. So, but since we did include North America in this, that, you know, I think that's a place that, you know, if Amazon follows through on that, that's going to cause a lot of direct stimulus, but also some ancillary stimulus.
Well, they wouldn't go to Vancouver because that's too close to Seattle. So you're thinking maybe Montreal or Toronto?
Yep, those are the two.
Now, you mentioned Montreal was hot. And last time I was in Toronto, which was a few years ago, there were construction cranes everywhere. I don't know, but I suppose that maybe has quelled since then. But that's an interesting question that's hanging in the balance. Where is Amazon going to put that second headquarters? And you make a good point if they actually follow through. Indy, what do you think? Other than Des Moines, Iowa, what's going to sizzle in 2018? For our listeners, Des Moines, Iowa is headquarters of Principal. Just I didn't want to just keep that an inside joke. But what's going to be hot, Indy?
Yeah. Sorry, I got bumped off shortly, Mike, so I'm back again. Yeah, I agree with Doug. Sizzle is a word I wouldn't usually use unless you're talking about climate change, but we'll leave that off. Our team, again, is following where the innovation is, right? So where is the innovation being done in this country? And you try and dovetail that where pricing looks reasonably attractive and where labor markets look strong. So, you know, the markets that we think still look reasonably attractive, you know, Seattle. Seattle is still, I think, got great demand and it's got some great growth drivers. Microsoft, Amazon, obviously two big giants in Seattle. But it's got a great educated workforce and the standard quality of life there is very attractive. So we like Seattle. We also like Denver for the reasons that we mentioned. It's also a great hub for clean air, clean energy and technology. And the quality of life there is very, very high for millennials who are relocating from different parts of the country. We think Los Angeles is also quite an interesting market. I'm obviously a little biased because that's my home market, but LA is a very diversified market. It's got historically been attached, associated with media and entertainment, but it's much more diverse now. It's become beach. Playa Vista is a massive market, very attractive, again, for the highly educated mobile workforce that I think the city would like to attract. Austin, you know, I agree with Doug, it's this really hot market. I still like Austin, but I think infrastructure is getting to a big problem. It's getting very crowded, a lot of new cranes. It's a little bit wary about Austin. So I would just say Seattle, Denver, Los Angeles is perhaps the three best ideas that we have for cities that could do quite well in 2018.
Our guests have been Indy Karlikar. He is head of global research at Principal Real Estate Investors, and Doug Putas, who is executive vice president and head of strategy at Canada-based Bentall Kennedy. Gentlemen, great job, and thank you for your time.